This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Booked for the Holidays. Written by Liz Maverick. Performed by Andrew Iden and Eva Kaminsky.
Chapter 1. Abby. Some people might think I got the short end of the stick. That by any definition, this unusual situation that I'm about to walk into is considered working during vacation. That I should be mad that I'm not taking a break from the breakneck New York holiday situation and going home to celebrate the Festival of Lights in a sleepy Minnesota suburb with my family. Not me. This is the long end of the stick. In fact, this is more like a wand or a scepter than a mere stick. The cab pulls up outside of a brownstone that looks more like a glorious set from some turn-of-the-century costume drama than an actual home. I can't even imagine owning an entire brownstone as a personal home, but that's what you get when you're a famous writer, I guess. I've got my laptop just in case, but it's the multiple gift bags full of bribes that I'm really counting on. Because I'm sure D.B. Ziegler does not want me to touch her next masterpiece. She just needs some moral support and perhaps an endless supply of delicious cookies and candies for her legendary sweet tooth. Her books are cozy mystery novels with a baking theme, each title punnier than the last. My favorite so far is Six Sweets Under, but the one that sold the most was Give Up the Toast. Obviously, as a baker, she can make her own cookies and candy. But right now, she's on a deadline, so I assume none of that is happening at the moment. Surely, this will fuel her right up and inspire her to get that manuscript in. Well, actually, nobody's exactly sure how to inspire her, because this is the first time she's failed to turn her manuscript in on time. Our entire publishing team was a little taken aback. She often failed to answer our emails and calls before, so that wasn't strange. But we've got to get this book out as soon as possible. I mean, it's the last one in the series. It's been on the publishing schedule forever. Marketing's been scheduled, and everybody's waiting, especially the folks in the finance department. So they sent me. They sent me because I'm a true fan. They also sent me because everybody else wanted to go home for the holidays. But I would have volunteered. Because Mrs. Ziegler is pushing 100 years old, her editor goes to her house every so often to brainstorm or discuss editing the latest manuscript. And I not only love and know her books, but I'm also interested in becoming known to more folks in the company as someone other than the dark-haired recent graduate next to Conference Room B, who is also responsible for ordering lunch. I could use a big win. Personally, I think me staying in town and helping move this last book forward is a win for everyone. And I'm sure Mrs. Ziegler and I will have so much to talk about. I can't see the address numbers on any of these homes, so I've been shuffling this way and that down the snowy sidewalk trying to check addresses. At last, there's a match. D.B. Ziegler's townhouse is postcard-perfect old Manhattan, with a brass patina railing and curated window boxes. It would take a generous amount of money to have professionals plant the winter-friendly foliage this precisely. Not to mention that they're decorated with beautiful swags of gold tinsel and white lights. Since I'm carrying packages, I use my elbow to ring the doorbell. I squeal in delight under my breath because even the chimes haven't been modernized. In fact, it sounds like I rang for a maid in one of those upstairs-downstairs dramas. And I am so here for that kind of vibe. I clench my jaw because my teeth are starting to chatter. Jumping up and down helps. What a character! I'm so lucky I get to meet her in person. And I really hope that happens soon because it's possible I will freeze on her doorstep. I elbow the doorbell again. The presents are getting kind of heavy, so I set them gently on the stoop. After about 5 minutes of hugging myself to stay warm, I ring the doorbell again. Finally, finally, the door opens a crack. Oh, this is so exciting. Happy holidays. It's me, Abigail Shore from...
Come in before all the cold air does,
says a deep, slightly congested male voice that sounds nothing like the 90-something-year-old Mrs. Ziegler I've heard giving acceptance speeches at award shows. I pause. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought... The door opens wider, and the man matching the voice sticks his head out. Come on in, he repeats, gesturing vigorously. I do not want to be responsible for giving Mrs. Ziegler a cold, so I step in, and he slams the door behind me. Thank you, I say. As I step over the threshold, I am enveloped by the delicious warmth of real, live fireplace heat drifting into the foyer. I'm suddenly looking into the face of a handsome, rumpled, somewhat crabby-looking guy around my age. He's tall, with arms that are muscular in the good way, that stop short of overdoing it, and he appears to have lucked into a lustrous head of dark, wavy hair. Beyond that, I don't think I've ever seen quite so many wrinkles in a short-sleeved plaid button-down before, and the glasses he's wearing are aggressively nerdy. In short, he's totally my type. That is, he would be if I weren't here for a completely different reason, to speak to a completely different person about a completely professional situation.
Let me clear a chair for you, he mumbles.
I watch him moving a stack of mail and magazines. There's really something familiar about him, though I think I'd remember meeting a human who looks this exhausted. Have we met before? I ask.
I don't think so,
he says peremptorily, not actually looking at me.
Okay, so I've assembled as many documents as I could find on the dining room table. I really appreciate you meeting me here instead of at the office. I've tried to make things as efficient as possible to make the best use of our time.
Manuscript pages cover almost every inch of Mrs. Ziegler's glossy antique dining room table. The dining room chairs themselves are upholstered in striped velvet. Packed china cabinets line the walls, with shelves piled high with mismatched teacups and decorative porcelain trays. The home is beautiful, bottom to top, from the Persian carpet to the ornate period molding on the edges of the ceiling. But I'm still holding the heavy bags. I'm all for efficiency, but this guy seems a little oblivious. Writers are delicate. You can't just jump in, all business at the first go. Mrs. Ziegler and I have never formally met before. If we're going to discuss her writer's block, I'd really like to establish a friendly rapport first, and possibly ply her with chocolate. Oh, there's no need to jump right into work, I say gaily. I've brought presents. The man turns his head slowly and blinks at me with a dead-eye stare. Happy holidays? I suggest in a faltering voice. He sighs a little. I deflate. Who wouldn't? But I'm not giving up. I try to keep spirits high. We could celebrate the season with a piece of toffee, in the pluckiest voice I can summon. Blink. Blink. Okay, this guy is the worst. He could suck the life out of a motivational seminar. I look around for Mrs. Ziegler because she is going to flip when she sees I brought her favorite toffee from Philomena's. Is Mrs. Ziegler available? That gets me a reaction. But it's not the one I was expecting, because gatekeeper dude freezes with a somewhat horrified expression on his face. I mean, at least I finally have his full and undivided attention, but still.
Who did you say you were? He asks. You don't seem like...
Why did you let me in if you didn't know who I was? Now I'm horrified.
Because the lawyer said she'd be here in 10 and it's been 5. That seemed like a plausible standard of deviation.
He runs a hand down his face.
And I'm a little out of it.
The lawyer? I'm not the lawyer. I'm from Mrs. Ziegler's publisher. I swear, he turns 5 shades of pale. I don't know what the lawyer's all about, but I do know now that he's aware that Mrs. Ziegler is struggling with her book. Ah, I say, dialing things way back and going back into full professional mode. It's as I thought. Well, please tell her not to worry. I can help. It's what I'm here for. She doesn't have to hide. In a fun sing-song voice, I add, and I brought that English toffee she loves. I brought all kinds of treats and inspiration. He blinks.
What are you here for?
Goodness, he's a bit dense. How can I put this in a way that allows Mrs. Ziegler to keep her dignity? But perhaps it's best to tell it like it is. I drop the sing-song voice. This guy is no fun at all. I'm with her publisher. I'm here to give her a little pep talk about the book she was supposed to turn in a while ago.
A while ago? It's late? He asks, looking quite alarmed. I thought it was due after the holidays. No. I'm starting to get a little annoyed. But when you're working with famous people, you get used to suppressing your actual emotions. He probably can't even detect the crisp new edge of my voice when I say, we'd agreed to move up the date for better marketing opportunities. Hey, you know, could you just go and get her for me? She wasn't responding to calls and emails even before the deadline. But I think she's going to be super motivated once she sees this box of toffee.
So you don't actually have an appointment. You just showed up at her house.
I can't quite suppress a note of uncertainty in my voice when I add, I brought presents? I mean, I assume that my boss made an actual appointment. This is the day I was asked to show up.
She's unavailable, he says rather rudely.
I'm beginning to feel jealous of the folks in Minnesota. Are you Mrs. Ziegler's assistant? I ask.
You could say that. I'm her grandson.
I knew I recognized him. Then we've met before. I mean, our paths have crossed. It's just you look different in pajama bottoms and glasses. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I was about to change before you got here, he mutters. I thought I had time. When did we meet?
Don't you escort her to the Edgar Awards every year that she's up? We had a conversation. You were wearing a tuxedo and employing a significant amount of hair product. I don't give him the compliments he really deserves for those efforts. He looked amazing, though. Anyway, I was there the year of the crazy shenanigans with... His phone rings, and he takes the call, saving me from having to continue talking to this blank wall about crazy shenanigans.
Dov Ziegler, he says.
He's on the phone, but his eyes are on me.
Right, he says. Uh-huh. I mean, I'd really like to get this resolved, but... Right, yes, understood. That works too.
He hangs up and sighs. He crosses into a shard of natural light that emphasizes the bags under his eyes. I'm starting to feel bad. I think I'm developing the urge to nurse him back to health, but he doesn't seem to respond well to things not involving his business. The lawyer isn't coming after all? I ask.
Not coming after all.
He looks around with disgruntlement. Okay, well, I see you're busy, so I won't stay long. If you could let Mrs. Ziegler know that I'm here, with presents. He stares blankly at the bags at my feet, then rouses himself enough to say,
How about I give you my phone number and we can take care of whatever this is on a call? Then you won't have to come back.
Ouch. Sheesh. But I wasn't looking for you, I say. I'm actually overheating a bit in this supremely cozy room. I start to take off my coat.
Whoa, he says, hands outstretched. You're not staying.
I don't care how famous his grandmother is. I am not going to suppress my total disgust at his rudeness. I whip the coat off my arms with a flourish and sling it over the side of the nearest chair. Since Dov does not make a move to take it from me like a proper host should. You do realize you are speaking out loud, right? I ask. I can hear you. And, you know, not everyone gets personal visits from their publisher the way she does, much less at Hanukkah and with treats. In fact, I've never even done an author visit before. I don't add that the pep talk I mentioned also means helping her get her book to the finish line if that's what she needs. I'm not sure if that's any of his concern. I want to talk to Mrs. Ziegler first. I'm actually surprised that I could place Dov Ziegler at the Edgars, because that version of him was smiling and dressed to the nines. I specifically recall the last awards ceremony when Mrs. Ziegler was wearing a bright blue dress with a lot of floating chiffon and rhinestones. That dress was pretty unforgettable. Dov here was her escort, wearing that tuxedo and working hard to look supportive but not distracting, which I think must be very hard when you're naturally this attractive. What isn't attractive is that away from the fancy parties and photo opportunities with his grandmother, he's ruder than I'd expect, which is so strange because Mrs. Ziegler is the epitome of warm and inviting. Her grandson is so cold in person, I might have to put my coat back on. It's really disappointing. If you wouldn't mind lending me paper and a pen, I'd like to leave Mrs. Ziegler a personal message before I go, I say, frosty enough to match him. He walks past me. I gape at him and follow him into a living room dominated by a cozy sofa, a fireplace, and an entire writing station. This is obviously Deborah Ziegler's writer's room. I'm in her office.
I clap my hands in delight.
Dove looks at me for a moment, and then sits in the computer chair and rifles his hands around in a mound of papers. I realize that a manuscript is sitting to the left of the monitor. I slide a notebook off the desk and flip the cover over. "I'll leave a message," I say, trying to get close enough to read the manuscript pages.
"She won't get it. She's not here,"
Dove mumbles into space. "But her book is," I say hopefully, craning my neck to sneak a peek. "That is her book, is it not?" He looks up at me with absolute incredulity. "It's the last book in the series, and I'm just so excited," I blurt. Dove studies my face for a moment, and then his mouth curls up at the corner. And I'm not sure why he's smiling at me, but it's the most delightful thing that's happened in the last 20 minutes. If only the bar weren't so low.
"It is her book. It will be turned in very soon, I'm sure."
He rummages around in the desk drawer and hands me a pen. And then, to my horror, hands me the title page of the manuscript to use as scratch paper. Under normal circumstances, I would leave and definitely take the goodie bags with me so he couldn't have the toffee, but now I can't. I can't because I'm not leaving her precious book around someone with such a careless attitude. He waves off my startled expression.
"I'll just print out another one."
I slowly take the title page and put the pen to paper under the words, "By D.B. Ziegler," not actually writing anything, while I crane my neck to see what's on page one of the manuscript now that the story is sitting there exposed. Is it done or not? That stack of paper looks thick enough to be pretty far along, but maybe not thick enough to be done. "Any chance I could see that?" I ask cheerfully. He cocks an eyebrow. He shifts in his chair. I'm not sure if it's intentional, but he's blocking the manuscript with his body. I try to crane my neck and look around him on the opposite side. He shifts his body to block me again. We both start laughing, and just like that, all the tension and awkwardness from earlier fades. "You realize how juvenile that is," I say, still laughing a bit.
"My friends tell me I get a pass for a month. Besides, why on earth would you think you have the right to see it?"
He stands up and hides the manuscript behind his back.
"Because I'm from her publisher?"
I try, make a self-deprecating face that recognizes I don't have a leg to stand on. "How about because I'm a huge fan and I'm dying to know how it ends?" I sigh. "Okay, both are true, but I admit I have no right." Dove raises the manuscript in both hands over his head.
"Sorry, this thing is sacred."
"I know. Why do you think I want to see it so badly?"
As much as I want to try and reach for the manuscript, I'm not actually sure if Deborah likes to share early pages with her editor. I assumed I'd see her here today and I'd simply ask. As it is, I don't want to overstep. "Never mind. If she's having writer's block, I don't want to make it worse. I'll leave her that note now." Dove stands there with the manuscript in his hands, staring at me with an expression that suggests a light bulb just turned on.
"Would you be able to tell how it's going?"
"I could get a sense of things," I say carefully. He hands me the first chapter. My heart starts pounding. I start reading. It begins with a bang. It's a fantastic start. Dove is looking at me expectantly. I hold out my hand, and after a moment's hesitation, he hands me the rest of the manuscript. It definitely feels too light. I skim a few more pages at the front, then rifle through the papers and pick a few sections in the middle and then one toward the end. Not all parts sound polished, and not all parts sound the same. I take the manuscript to a comfy blue velvet sofa and sit down. I back up and read some more, finding the general area where I suspect the prose starts to lose its shine. And then suddenly, the story drops off completely. I sit back and take stock of the situation. The setup is probably in good shape. Much of the book is going to be about pulling loose threads together and resolving relationships that fans have been waiting for throughout the series. But even skimming quickly, I can tell that the middle isn't in the same sort of shape. It's choppier the closer it gets to the end. Well, oh boy, there doesn't really seem to be an end yet. I bite my lip and look up at Dove, who's been waiting quietly on his perch on the wide, curved arm of the sofa. A muscle in his jaw is throbbing, In the unforgiving light of Deborah's writing desk, he's haggard again.
Well? He asks.
Well, I say, trailing off. It's not done,
but it's close. I bite my lip.
I'm pretty sure it's not quite there. He leans against the desk, a wary expression on his face. I think we both know I'm just being nice. I take the title page and write a short note to Deborah, giving her my phone number and asking her to call me. Please give this to Mrs. Ziegler. I'll be here for the whole break. I can help her. If we really put our heads together, we have a chance to get this book in shape by the time everybody's back from the break. I put my coat back on and grab my things in a bit of a daze. Dove is staring at the manuscript. I'll see myself out, I say loudly. He doesn't answer. I shake my head and walk out the door. It's still freezing outside, and I haven't fully buttoned up my coat, but my hands are full. About 3 blocks toward the subway, I can't take the cold anymore and put down my bags, only to realize with horror that I shouldn't still have the bags. I took Mrs. Ziegler's presents with me when I left. I'm going to have to go back. What a pain. Should I bother? But the more I stare at the presents, the more that whole experience begins to strike me as odd. Something about Dove was odd. I pick up the bags and start back to the townhouse. I think of myself as such an observant person, so what did I miss? Dove Ziegler was expecting a lawyer. Almost nobody expects a lawyer because something good is happening. Isn't that right? I've now slowed down to the point where I'm barely shuffling through the snow, and annoyed New Yorkers begin to pile up behind me on the sidewalk. I step aside to let them by. In my single-minded determination to meet with Mrs. Ziegler, perhaps I was rude too. I interrupted him in the middle of something bad, and then I wouldn't leave and kept babbling about toffee while he was trying to deal with some sort of crisis. Also, he had eye bags the size of Texas. He was only just considering changing out of pajama bottoms at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. I stopped dead in my tracks. Oh no, I think I read him all wrong. That guy was sad. How could I have been so blind? So full of myself. I clench my fists, squeezing the life out of the bag handles. This guy is literally suffering in front of me, and I'm running around demanding to see manuscript pages I have no right to see. Is that why Mrs. Ziegler is late? Is there something wrong with her grandson and she's taking care of him? I turn around and start to walk briskly back to the townhouse. I'm definitely leaving the treats with him. He needs them more than I do.
Chapter 2. Dove. I need to pull myself together. To say I haven't been myself since Bubby passed away is something of an understatement, but I should have tried harder to be nice to that woman, if for no other reason than that she seemed to be an actual D.B. Ziegler fan. That was all a little crazy. I look over to where my grandmother's manuscript is spilling over on the sofa and pick up the last page this Abigail Shore was reading. Is it that bad? I thought it was going well. Clearly, I'm delusional. It's bad enough that Bubby's gone. It's another level of crazy that she's asked me to take on this favor, and it's beyond crazy itself that I'm doing it. Apparently, it might not be going as well as I'd hoped. The only silver lining here is that since Bubby always had a big sense of humor, I expect she is somewhere laughing and loving all of this. When I told the financial advisory company I work for that I was taking a leave of absence after the death of a family member, I don't think they imagined me using the time to finish a mystery novel. I don't think they imagined me sitting in my underwear in a massive brownstone alone at the onset of the holidays trying to fulfill Bubby's last wish. It's a pretty monumental task, if you ask me, given that I'm supposed to figure out how to meld a gentle mystery story set during the holidays centering around the death of an old lady and incorporating a side plot involving an adorable rescue dog and large cast of small-town characters. Whew! And this isn't the only thing I have on my plate in my life right now, either. I've hardly had time to be full-time sad. I'm being asked to do things that don't involve the stock market or federal regulations. I'm so far out of my wheelhouse, it's not even funny. Not to mention, I'm doing all of this in the middle of my grandmother's favorite time of year, but without any of the traditions and fun we always had during them. I don't think, however, that the fact that I'm having a hard time is an excuse to give someone else a hard time. Bubby would not approve. I owe Abigail an apology. Out the window, it's snowing again. The media's been promoting Snowmageddon 2.0, and it looks like this is the pregame show. I pull boots on and stuff my pajama bottoms inside, and then throw on a parka. It's icy out there, so maybe she didn't get far. With all the can-do and momentum I possess in my soul, I throw open the door, and it is that can-do and momentum that carries me forward so swiftly I cannot stop even when I slam straight into Abigail Shore, who has either returned or never left my stoop. There is no redeeming aspect to this situation. She was staring out at the sidewalk with her back to my door, so now I'm lying on top of her back, smashing the rest of her face first into the snow. I scramble up and turn her over. Her face is quite pink, and she's in a bit of shock. She's probably very cold. "Have you been out here for a while?" I ask, perhaps too casually. She nods and sneezes. I felt super awkward, so I was working my way up to ringing the doorbell again. "Now I feel super awkward," I say. I'm dusting snow off her face, and it's melting, so I'm really just smearing cold water all over a stranger's face. This won't do, no matter how crappy I feel. I pull her up and march her back into the foyer of my townhouse. "I want to apologize, but first let's get you warm."
"You can't," Abigail says in a panic, pulling back.
"Why not?"
"Let me talk first. I was coming back to apologize and give you this."
She holds out the bag of presents.
"I have no idea why I took them with me. Even if Mrs. Ziegler isn't in town to enjoy any of it, I want you to have it. It might cheer you up a little. And could you please tie your coat when you go out in the cold next time? You don't want to be sick in addition to sad."
I stare down at her. "I never said I was sad.
Aren't you?"
I can't really get any words out. I make a show of taking off my coat so she doesn't see me looking exactly as sad as she probably thinks I am. If she's from Bubby's publishing house, in good conscience, I really can't keep pretending. I'm going to have to tell her. "Listen, Abigail, there's something. It is really very hard to say what I need to say, even though it's not like this happened yesterday." I steel myself, putting my hands on my hips and staring down at the bag of presents. "There's something I need to tell you about my grandmother."
"I get it. She didn't finish her book and she's embarrassed and maybe has a bit of writer's block," she says. "Is that why she hasn't called? Is it because it's the last book of the series and she's freaking out? This is all normal. Listen, I'm one of your grandmother's absolute biggest fans. I would never disparage her writing, and first drafts are almost always, well, crappy. I'm here to help. I know her series almost as well as her editor does. I've read all her books a million times, and granted, I'm a bit low on the totem pole, but I'm a trained publishing professional. I will be able to get the best out of her so she doesn't have to hide. Please tell her that. I'm here because we care about her legacy."
"You truly like her work," I say, searching her face. I'm really very moved.
"I do," she says. "I love her work."
We stand there in a silence that's beginning to get a little embarrassing. "You're right. She didn't finish her book," I finally manage to say. "And she won't be able to." She's waiting for me to finish the thought, to start discussing a broken wrist that makes it impossible to type, or to explain how my grandmother's gone on vacation. Unexpectedly, my eyes tear up. Abigail's eyes lock on mine. And then all at once, she gasps and covers her mouth with her mittens. I clear my throat and take cover in the business of removing her voluminous coat and brushing the rest of the snow off to the foyer floor while she stands there in shock. "I'll make some tea," I mutter. "There's a blanket on the couch you can grab if you're cold." I go to the kitchen and try to have the wherewithal to make some tea, but my mind is going off in a million directions. And now it's me standing at the sink, not moving, telling myself to keep it together. So maybe it wasn't yesterday, but how long is long when it comes to missing someone you love? And then suddenly a very cold hand takes the tea kettle out of my grip, and Abigail quietly says, "I'll make it. I don't argue. It's nice to not be in charge of something while a very competent person bustles around my kitchen and makes something happen. I find a couple of plates, some napkins, then grab a box of candy from the bag of gifts Abigail brought over. We're finally sitting together at the small square table in the corner of the kitchen where Bubby had her morning tea. It's still set with the round placemats she embroidered with purple irises. Freed from the coat that was swallowing her alive, Abigail looks tiny and sad on her side, her flushed pink and still slightly damp face staring into a steaming mug of Bubby's favorite black tea. A single piece of toffee sits on her dessert plate untouched. "Is it Abigail or some other nickname?" I ask.
"It's Abby, actually. I work for the Tea and Sympathy imprint at Mrs. Ziegler's publishing company."
I can see she's weepy, so I push the toffee closer. She looks up at me and says,
"I'm sorry. This is really embarrassing. I just really loved her books."
I'm confused. "But you didn't really know her?"
"But I knew her books."
She looks at me.
"I'm sad for you because you must be so sad in every way. And I'm sad for me because her series is over and there won't be any more, and she worked so hard to bring her readers joy. They were such wonderful books."
I try to remember feeling that way about a book or an author. I'm sad because Bubby was my favorite person, and the holidays have never felt so long and so quiet. "At least there will be one more," I say into my mug.
"Right,"
she says, and then stills.
"Wait, what? She didn't finish, so..."
Okay, here goes. This is a gamble, but at worst, I've technically just informed the publisher of my plans, so nobody can say I'm trying to trick anybody. Which I'm not. I'm just doing what I have to do. Actually, I'm going to finish it. That's what I'm doing here. Abby sits up, ramrod straight.
"What?"
Her eyes are wide.
"You think you can finish her book? Is that why you look like you do? You can't do that."
I narrow my eyes at her. I've been told I'm reasonably attractive, actually. "What do you mean? How do I look?"
"Oh, nothing. Never mind. I don't know what I'm talking about."
She's biting on her lower lip and there's a giant furrow in her brow. "Just say it. I can take it. I'm fine. I'd like to know how I look. Really." I flash a forced smile trying to tip the odds in my favor. I thought I looked fairly normal writing the end of someone else's book. "Go ahead. No hard feelings."
Well...
Abby shifts in her chair and smiles kindly at me. "This can't be good."
"One might say that you look like someone living through a hard time, who is also making weird choices."
"I'm not making weird choices. I have a rock-solid basis for these choices." She clams up again.
"Sorry, do go on." "I don't know if this is productive,"
she says. I chuckle a little. "I think you're actually doing a really great job of insulting me without making me feel worse."
"That's a terrible way to describe constructive criticism," Abby says. "It's a gentle art. It's what good editors do. Let's flip this around, shall we? What makes you think you're qualified to work on her book?"
I set my jaw. "Because I'm an intelligent human being, and I can do anything I put my mind to. Most things are a matter of focus and determination. If I want to finish this book, I will finish this book. I don't mention that besides focus and determination, it seems to also involve drinking more beer than I expected, while walking around in boxer shorts and swearing a lot under a higher state of stress than I expected. Sometimes there's a lot more of all that drinking and walking and swearing than there are words. But it's a fact that when I set my mind to something, I do it. I'll see this thing through to the end, no matter how underqualified Abby thinks I am."
"Just to clarify," Abby says, "with that mindset, which is very impressive, by the way, I believe that you can finish this book. I don't believe you can make it great. Not to mention, the powers that be at the imprint won't just let you sub in."
She accompanies this statement with some really aggressive air quotes on the sub in part. "Your house doesn't use ghost writers?" I ask. There's a terrifying pause, and then Abby bursts into gusts of genuine laughter.
Oh my gosh, I bet Mrs. Ziegler would have loved that joke so much.
She really, really would have. Bubby would have loved Abigail Shore coming over with toffee during the holidays to sit at this table and talk books, too, while she fried donuts in the kitchen for Hanukkah. I'm more determined than ever to make good on my promise. You're going to have to keep this to yourself, I say. Abby sniffs with disdain.
You're asking me not to tell my boss that one of our most beloved top authors has passed away without completing the series final, and that her grandson fancies he can simply complete it in her stead?
You don't understand. This isn't about me. She gives me a look. I'm serious. My grandmother hated the idea of leaving the series unfinished for her fans, and she also didn't want her readers to be sad. So she asked me to keep her passing quiet until the last book came out. When she realized she wouldn't finish the manuscript in time herself, she asked me to do it. So I promised I would keep her secret and turn in the best finished book that I could. Yes, I may not be able to make it great, but I'll give it my all. And at worst, I will make it very good. Anything less is not delivering on my promise. She's quiet for a while, sipping at her tea while she thinks. I realize I'm asking a huge favor here. I stare at her intently, willing her to help me out with this request. Abby sizes me up.
If you're being serious, then I'll be serious too.
I nod. Her eyes lock with mine and she says,
"Very good is not going to happen for you. Passable, at best, is what we're looking at here. But Deborah Ziegler's last book needs to be better than passable."
"Well, it will be what it will be because she's not here," I say.
"But I am."
"So? You don't have any skin in the game." I sit back in my chair and ask, not unkindly, "I mean, what was going to happen to you if the book never got turned in?" And then I remember, "Oh," I say, "you mentioned you were low on the totem pole. Did you take on the assignment of holiday companion to my grandmother in hopes you might become less junior? I'm not trying to be a jerk. I just figure that if my cards are on the table, yours should be on the table too." Abby puts down her mug and frowns.
"Why is it weird that I want your grandmother's last book to be released, and that I want it to be as good as the others?" she asks. "I'm a huge fan of her work. Isn't that a good enough reason for me to want to help?"
"Maybe," I think to myself. "But does her motivation even matter? I just need her not to tell the folks back at the publishing house that I'm finishing my grandmother's book until it's done. Otherwise, there's a high chance they'll automatically put the kibosh on the whole thing." "I think this can be a win-win," I say, "if you don't mind keeping the secret for a little longer."
Abby glowers at me. "I don't think anyone is going to ask me about the book during the holiday," she hedges. "But I do think they'll ask me on the first day back at work because everyone is going to panic if it's still not in. So you have 2 weeks to get that draft in shape."
She gazes at me.
"That isn't always easy for even an experienced writer."
"I want to finish the book," I say stubbornly.
"I want her book to be finished too," she says.
"So, how about you just go away and wait for the manuscript to come in on the first day back at work?" I suggest, using my most pleasant voice. Abby chews on her lower lip as we eye each other warily.
"You need me,"
she says quietly. "I need her? I don't want to need her. I just want her to pretend for a couple of weeks that she doesn't know what she knows." So I don't answer. After a fairly long moment of silence, Abigail's eyebrows go up. I still don't invite her to join me in whatever crazy writing escapade she's obviously cooking up in her head. Finally, the silence becomes too awkward and her eyebrows go back down. She nods and then calmly gets up and heads for the foyer. From my seat, I see her put on her coat. I feel so strange, like I somehow played that all wrong even though I can't see where. She's leaving. I don't think she's going to tell me what she's planning next, but that's okay. I'm going to turn the book in on the first day back from the holidays and everything will be fine. Why doesn't it feel fine? I get up and stand in the kitchen doorway.
"Call me if you need me,"
Abby says. She raises a sticky note in the air and then fixes it on the inside of the door.
"I put my number here."
She buttons up and then turns to me, one hand on the doorknob of the front door, adding softly,
"I'm so very sorry you lost your grandma. Abby steps out of my line of sight, but I hear her tugging on the heavy door. My gaze shifts to the vision of falling snow beyond the picture window. The door is going to close behind her, and it's going to get very, very quiet in here. Wait a sec, I blurt. She turns before stepping outside, a hopeful expression on her face. I grab the clipped manuscript from the desk in the living room and meet Abby in the foyer. I reach behind her, pushing the heavy door closed against the frosty winter air. Okay, maybe we need each other, I say. I wouldn't want to be the reason you didn't get a promotion. I'm sure wherever Bubby is, she's laughing at me. Our eyes meet. Abby puts her hand out, one arched eyebrow challenging me. I clap the manuscript into her hand and she grins. See you tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., she says as she walks out and closes the door behind her. 8 in the morning? What have I done?
Chapter 3. Abby. I've got a copy of D.B. Ziegler's unpublished manuscript in my bag. And while I'm still shaken up from the news about Mrs. Ziegler's passing, having this final story with me makes me feel like smiling instead of crying. What an honor to have this amazing woman's final work in my care. I send up a silent promise to guard it like a precious treasure. All around me, Manhattan is flipping on the holiday lights for the evening. It's magical to see. So I pull my coat closer and head toward a subway line that'll give me a longer but prettier walk. With all my friends and family out of town, there's nowhere in particular that I have to be. And it's the perfect moment to catch my breath. Instead of hurrying past the vendors on the edge of the park, hawking stocking stuffers and holiday treats, I let myself linger. I could buy festive Hanukkah socks or classic roasted chestnuts, or a CD of jazzy Christmas songs from a pop-up sidewalk table decorated for Kwanzaa. I could linger by an a cappella group singing cover songs, or buy a Dixie cup of cider with an apple cinnamon spice muffin, or even choose a French crepe from a booth on the corner. In New York, they say anything is possible, and I believe this to be true. Maybe that's why I didn't think longer about signing up for such a crazy scheme with D.B. Ziegler's grandson, who is obviously engaged in a pretty unique version of mourning. I buy a cup of cider and sit down at a rickety table next to the vendor stalls. I take out the manuscript and flip through it a bit more, skipping back to the part where the prose gets thinner and then stops. I sip my drink, all warm and snuggly in my coat and hat, and calculate how much I will need to write per day to finish on time. The answer is a lot. My phone buzzes. It's a texted snapshot of my friends Leia and Sophie wrapped in spa towels. They are making sad faces, and the caption says, "We miss you." "Aw," I text back, and then stuff the manuscript back in my bag and toss the Dixie cup in the trash. It's a beautiful winter's evening, so when my text is answered by a phone call, I decide to answer it and walk home instead of taking the subway. "Season's greetings," I say in a jocular tone. "Are you cold yet?" Sophie asks. Sophie and I met at work on my first week in publishing, and we've been best friends ever since. She was kind of hard to miss in the coffee room, what with her deep commitment to the simultaneous use of stripes and polka dots. It could be said that she has a personality to match. It wasn't a surprise to learn she's a freelance cover designer. D.B. Ziegler's cover designer, in fact. I hadn't thought about that before answering the phone. She's waiting on the same manuscript I am. "Hey," I say. "Colder than you, obviously." She laughs. "So, did you get to meet her today?" What to say? I stare down at my boots, plowing through the snow on the sidewalk. The thing is, something happened.
"Oh?"
I need you to keep it to just me and Leia. In a deep in the vault, I'm being serious kind of way. Yes, it's the real deal. Nobody at work can know right now.
"At work? Gosh," Sophie says. "Understood."
I take a deep breath. "Deborah Ziegler passed away." Sophie sucks in a quick breath, and then there is silence.
I watch the snow crunch under my boots as she processes the information.
That's just so sad, Sophie says.
I realize she was in her 90s and had an amazing life, but she will be missed. And what about her series, the last book? Better hit her with the rest of it while she's already down. In fact, I have the last D.B. Ziegler manuscript in my bag.
She finished it?
Sophie asks, sounding relieved. Well, there are some outstanding details to work out. Like a third of the book to write, I think to myself. Before you ask, the breed of the rescue dog hasn't quite been decided. Sophie sighs. She needs to know what breed of dog is going to be in this last book to finish designing the cover. It wouldn't be a D.B. Ziegler cozy mystery without desserts and a dog on the cover. The thing is, Sophie, I say, it seems that Mrs. Ziegler is going to have some help finishing up her book. I explain it as best I can, and she's as shocked as I was. Let me get this straight, she says. You're going to try and help D.B. Ziegler's grandson finish the book and the series by the time we get back to work? You understand that's a bit nuts, right?
Can you just trust me on this?
Sophie sighs loudly.
Are you talking to Abby?
Says a voice in the background.
Hi, Leia,
I yell into my phone. There's a bit of chaos on the other side, and then Leia's softer voice says,
Hi, we miss you. It feels weird you didn't come too. Are you having a happy Hanukkah?
Sure am, I say cheerfully. We're going to be late, Sophie hollers in the background.
I have to go, Leia says. We're doing cupping therapy. I'm not convinced I want marks on my back that look like alien experimentation, but I promised Sophie I'd go. Talk soon.
Later. I pocket my phone and pick up my pace. A gentle sprinkling of cotton-soft snow drifts from the sky, a far cry from the sunny rays being enjoyed by my friends. And yet, the unexpected situation with Dove Ziegler doesn't feel like a second-place prize or an imposition. I kind of love the idea that I'll be spending my holiday working on a D.B. Ziegler manuscript with her fiercely protective grandson in a massive, book-strewn Upper West Side townhouse. Okay, maybe I won't be working with him. I mean, I'm sure he has other things to do while I write, but maybe having me there working on the book will be at least a little like having Mrs. Ziegler's warm, dedicated presence in the room. That said, Dove seems like he'd benefit from going outdoors and getting some air. The man looks rough, and he probably needs a hug. Half a block away from my house, I pop into the neighborhood bodega and pick up some matches. And when I finally make it up to my apartment, the first thing I do is rummage around in my closet for a Yahrzeit candle. The timing is off, because obviously it's not the anniversary of D.B. Ziegler's death. But I light the candle in tribute all the same and pull out her manuscript.
Don't worry, I tell the flame. I'll help your grandson. Don't worry one little bit about him or your book.
I turn to page one, grab a red pencil, and begin to read.
Dove. Maybe I shouldn't have told Abigail Shore about my grandmother and my plans to finish her last book. My friends Daniel and Caleb are the only other people who know everything. I'm not sure what I was thinking. I hope Abby is trustworthy. I mean, I wouldn't have handed her a copy of the manuscript so easily if I didn't have a good feeling about her. I have to believe she'll show up tomorrow like she said. Truth be told, I'm thrilled to have someone invested in the book coming over. Maybe it will help me focus better, because clearly I'm having trouble getting inspired if I've resorted to listening to Bubby's old playlists in an effort to absorb her writing energy. This is why, instead of writing, I'm currently sliding up and down the wood floor in the hall in tube socks and boxers while I finish my third beer of the evening. A Meatloaf song is playing, and I'll be done with the last swig just in time to free up my fingers for air guitar. After Abigail left, I had to reschedule with the estate lawyers, which threw me off my game. I ended up spending the rest of the afternoon checking the stock market, worrying about losing my job if I stay on leave too long, and tying different selections from my grandmother's beloved Hermes scarf collection around my forehead. The song starts to fade out, and I slide dramatically down the hall on my socks, ending in front of the hall mirror. I stop fake strumming my air guitar, and the pink and orange twilly I'm wearing 70s glam rocker style on my head flops over my eyes. I seriously need to come up with a new way to not feel sad. This was all really amusing the first couple of times, but I'm beginning to feel kind of gross. I suppose having someone from Bubby's publisher show up on my doorstep and agree to come back is a real piece of luck. I head for the kitchen and toss my empty beer can into the recycling. This time I choose better, grabbing bottled water instead. After guzzling it down, I head back to the living room to the computer to stare at the pages for a while, idly looking outside the large picture window as I pass. Wait, is that? Something is coming into view at top speed. A little bleary, I step closer to the window, and sure enough, a small dog with curly ginger fur is racing down the sidewalk, full bore. Ears flapping, little legs windmilling like crazy. No leash, no visible owner. Definitely on the loose and headed for trouble because that patch up ahead of him isn't just dark cement. Oh, pup, you're gonna wanna slow. Oh, yikes. The dog skedaddles on a patch of black ice and goes sliding about 3 feet before landing in a snowbank, paws akimbo. I start to laugh, but it's only hilarious if the dog is okay. I head for the door and swing it open. Now I'm standing on my doorstep in my undershorts and socks with a scarf on my head. It's not my best moment, but if he needs me, I'll put shoes on. The dog's legs flail wildly until it rights itself and then goes running off at top speed out of view again. I look to the right, waiting to see if an owner appears. No such person. And then I look again to the left to see if the dog has slowed down. No such luck. It's not even in sight. Suddenly, a man in a distinctive Navy doorman's uniform with red piping huffs into view. He slows and looks around. That way, I call, pointing in the correct direction. He waves and keeps chugging after the dog, one hand on his head to keep his fancy hat on. You got this, I yell, cheering him on. My phone rings. I accept the call and head back into the house.
Howdy, says a male voice.
I don't have to look at caller ID to know that deep voice is my buddy Caleb.
Daniel says he talked to you earlier. He says you're doing okay.
Yep, I say, wandering around the living room with the phone to my ear. I think I just laughed at something, or maybe I merely thought it was funny and didn't get all the way to laughing. It's hard to say, but we can call it an improvement.
Do you remember what we discussed?
Caleb asks. I have such great friends. Take some showers, eat some salad.
Yeah. Is it happening?
I very much plan on both of those things happening soon. Like tomorrow, at the latest, I say. I don't want to tell him about Abigail Shore in case she bails. The last thing I need is another reason for people to feel sorry for me and start calling me to follow up on my vegetable intake.
Did you hear what I just said? Caleb asks.
I think he was still talking about vegetables.
Mm-hmm, I say. It's the second night of Hanukkah. Did you light the candles?
I glance over at the brass menorah in the window. Unlit candles from yesterday poke out of the right side.
Go light the candles. It's nice, you know?
Okay.
I'll be back in town in a few days, he says. Let me know if you need anything.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Of course, Caleb says. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah, I say, and hang up. I need to go write. I need to make some progress. Instead, I sit down on the sofa and stare out the window. There's a couple doing the Christmas tree drag down my block.
That's always fun to watch.
In this case, they don't seem to be arguing, so it's a cheerful tableau. Across my narrow street, there's another brownstone like a mirror image of mine. Through their picture window, I see a fireplace roaring and a lot of hanging fairy lights. It looks like a holiday party is ramping up. It looks nice. Fun, festive, full of family and friends. Maybe next year. I take a match out of the box on the windowsill and strike it, lighting candles for yesterday and tonight while murmuring the prayer. Even talking this low sounds very loud when I'm by myself. The flames flicker a bit as I watch the party for a little longer until it occurs to me that if I can see them, they can see me alone by the candlelight in the window. I step back out of view and go back to the computer, find my place in the text, and start typing.
Chapter 4. Abby. It's an absolutely gorgeous morning. As I stand on the stoop, waiting for Dove to answer the door, I stare up at the townhouse. I'll bet this thing has 4 toilets. I mean, a whole townhouse with multiple floors, including 4 toilets, sounds like a glorious fantasy world inhabited by lucky people with supple skin and perfect hair who get all the gelt while playing dreidel. In other words, it's hard for a typical New Yorker to imagine. The idea of D.B. Ziegler living here, shuffling around making tea and boiling down fruit and sugar for jam while multitasking at her computer, really charms me. From her workstation in the living room, she'd likely be able to hear Dove's footsteps upstairs or the faint clink of teaspoons in the kitchen just off the hall. And that couch in the living room next to her desk, with its huge crocheted doily afghan in front of the real wood-burning fireplace, well, it's exactly how you'd imagine her. I think about her grandson wandering around all that space in the middle of the holidays, mourning his grandmother and trying to do the impossible. I kind of can't believe she asked that of him. Maybe she didn't have anybody else. Maybe their family is as scattered as mine. When I was little, I'd go to all my cousins' bar and bat mitzvahs and weddings, and even some of the graduations. But now that we've all grown up, the world isn't held together with that kind of glue anymore. It's easier to fly than it once was, and yet we make the effort far less for various reasons. Plenty of good reasons included, I suppose. But we've definitely lost something over the years. In my memory bank, I have a ton of Hanukkah parties and big family occasions. But in my current life, not so much. That's how it is, I suppose. That one moment Dove can be drinking tea with one of the most important women in his life, and then a month or two later, he's left standing alone in that same kitchen with an aching heart. When did he lose her? And why can't I stop thinking about them? How did he manage to make such an impression on me? I mean, he really must have, since I've spent all morning wondering who hugs him when he's sad. I nearly made myself cry just thinking about it while brushing my teeth. And by the time I'd finished getting dressed, I felt extra compelled to text my family in Minnesota to tell them that I love them and that I hope they have a really fun Hanukkah party to go to this year. I ring the doorbell again. I'm about to call Dove when the door opens. I mean, I think it's Dove. For a moment, I'm thrown because the intense wave of brewery smell is kind of unexpected. Also, I can't see his face because it's stuck in the armpit of a long-sleeve waffle weave shirt. Perhaps he's not a morning person.
"You're early," he says in a muffled voice.
"By 5 minutes," I say. If it had been summer, I'd have waited on the stoop before ringing. Dove's head finally pops through the neck hole. Yikes. He looks really terrible, from gravity-defying bedhead to wrinkled boxer shorts. "Oh, wow," I say, shielding my eyes to avoid mutual embarrassment.
"I was up late working on the book," he says quickly.
I mean, there's a precedent set for famous authors who drank a lot while writing, but I don't think most of them ended well.
"I was just about to shower," he says defensively.
"And also, it's not like I'm indecent." "Maybe it's a little much for a near stranger," I tease. There's a pause. Almost more to himself, he mutters,
"I think we're more than near strangers. You definitely don't seem like a stranger."
I blink at him. He's right. We don't seem like strangers. I'm not sure why.
"So how about I go take that shower while you read the manuscript?"
"I already read the manuscript," I say.
"A close reading, I mean. I know you skimmed it when you were here yesterday."
"I did a close reading too. I took it home last night, remember?" Now it's his turn to blink at me.
"You'd have to have stayed up all night to read the complete manuscript," he says,
looking at me like I'm a bit nutso.
"If you were reading for full comprehension, anyway."
Obviously, I stayed up all night reading. He looks very surprised. "As one does," I say, testing him, because I'm beginning to suspect.
"Really?"
he asks. I frown. "You've never stayed up all night with a great book?" He thinks about it. Oh, dear. Well, it's lucky, really. I can't possibly develop a crush on a guy who doesn't read. This fact will help set proper boundaries for our working relationship. I clear my throat. "Anyway, how's the writing going, Hemingway?" He gives me a huge, blinding smile and says, Well, it's all coming together in my head.
I am immediately suspicious.
In your head?